Craig, thank you so much for being a part of this. This is a big honor for me. I've followed your work for years and watched your videos, and I connect. I think my taste, because we all have our own tastes as to
Sure.
what we love. I really connect with your taste. Like, the symbols that you make
Oh.
really, really resonate with me. So I'm really happy to
Thank you.
have a chat with you, and we can talk about whatever you want to. But yeah, anyway, thanks for being on.
Pleasure. My pleasure. Yeah.
So typically when I do these interviews, we just start by a little intro to who you are. You're a fantastic drummer as well as a cymbal smith. So I imagine your journey becoming a cymbal smith probably involved you as a musician and kind of transitioning into that. Or I'll let you say it in your own words, but give me a little bit of a backstory on you.
I started playing drums pretty young. Well, not pretty young, as a teenager. And then I did a bunch of jobs and decided at about 21 to go back and study music. So I did a certificate in commercial music and then went in on to university to do some a jazz course there. And at that stage, I found it hard to find like a cymbal that had the voice that I wanted it to have. So the cymbal thing started really probably just like you, just as a quest for sounds. You put all this time into learning your craft, into getting your touch together and doing all that kind of stuff, and then you go through that process. I'm sure you probably did too, where you have sounds in your head and you want to kind of realize those sounds. And for me, I just couldn't find cymbals that did it at when I was going through that phase. So I started rehammering stuff that I had, and it went from there. I used to experiment on whatever I could get my hands on. And then I got in touch with a Turkish foundry. And first of all, I was getting cymbals in to sell to students. And I'd get cymbals and I'd think, I could just kind of do a couple of things to those. And so I'd rehammer them a bit. And then I started getting blanks. And yeah, it went from there. So it was really just about trying to. Again, I felt comfortable with my playing, with my touch, with all that kind of stuff. And I just wanted to realize those sounds. And the only way it seemed that I could do that was by making cymbals myself. So,
Yeah, that's
yeah.
awesome. And what in the early days, was there has your taste changed? I mean, I'm sure it has, but has your taste changed? Can you talk a little bit about your taste in the beginning when you were trying these cymbals? You weren't really happy with what you were finding, and then you started experimenting. What was your aim then, and how has it changed to where you're at now?
Yeah, that's a good question. My aim then was, because you have thousands of hours of listening. You're just listening all the time. And I'd do what all the drummers do. I'd listen to Tony Williams and I'd listen to Elvin and I'd listen to all those sounds. And it just seemed that something about that sound palette just was really difficult to find. So obviously, that was the initial direction. And then once I started making cymbals and exploring those sounds and kind of getting to the point where I thought I was, getting close to realizing some sounds that I was hearing in my head, then it was just about experimentation after that point. So I kind of got to a point where I thought, okay, cool, I can kind of get things going in the direction that I want them to go in. And so by that stage I was selling some stuff and there were a bunch of guys that were asking me to make them things. And So I started going down that route a lot more. And of course, then it's just experimentation. So, you know, you're just experimenting constantly. That's what I was doing. Like, I'd say, you know, as much as I was making stuff, I was experimenting with sounds and you know, doing all sorts of stuff, you know, sandpapering stuff, putting buffers on cymbals, you know, doing all sorts of weird things with bits of wood and like blunt kind of lathing with different bits of metal, and just trying all the things. And kind of in 2008, I went to Europe and I spent some time with Roberto Spizzichino. I visited Michael Paisty in his workshop and in Lucerne. I went and visited Matt Nolan, who kind of at that stage was, I don't think he was kind of going, he was learning a lot of stuff. And I think he was getting a lot of stuff from Steve Hubbock, who I also visited as well. So, you know, I was starting out, Matt was passionate about it and he was kind of starting out as well. But again, spending time with Roberto, spending time with, well, Steve Hubbock is an amazing kind of smith in his own right. Michael Paisty. I went to the Frankfurt Music Messe, and I met a bunch of Turkish guys there, and it kind of helped me shore up getting some blanks and all that kind of stuff. And so I have to say that visiting Roberto, his workshop, his ethic, his personality, you know, like all that stuff was amazing. And it really just flicked a switch. I'd already gotten some Spizzichinos, like I'd already gotten some stuff that he'd made me, and playing it, and I loved it. And I thought, man, this is really like something that I love, you know, like as much as I love the Tony Williams sound or something like that, you know, the Roberto stuff was just really resonated with me. And so then I guess after that, I spent a lot of time trying to recreate some of those sounds, you know, still exploring my own thing and still going down the, like, because you know what it's like, you have a piece of bronze and you hit it and you listen to it and you go, okay, what am I going to do with it now? And then you take it to the next step. So still doing all that kind of stuff. But I did a bunch of things where I, you know, tried to duplicate Roberto's sounds and, you know, tried to duplicate old Case. We've all done it, right? I don't know how successful I was, but it was a great learning experience. And I guess what I'm saying is that kind of after that time, it became a lot wider than just trying to make nice jazz cymbals, or, you know, like it became a lot wider than me just trying to find sounds that I was happy playing, you know? So like things really opened up for me then in terms of exploration and what I was hearing and trying to develop different sounds and, you know, following different ideas and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you know, it's just a progression. I don't know how it started for you, but certainly in the beginning it was about my own sound. Then I investigated other smiths and thought, okay, this is really cool. And what are they doing here? And you reverse engineer all the stuff and you try and recreate it. And you get ideas and you go, man, I really love this sound, but that's kind of a Roberto sound. And I can never really do that like he does it, but what part of what he's doing can I kind of try and recreate in my own stuff? And
yeah,
you know, it never stops. I mean, it'll never stop. Like I said, the other day I came across some hi-hats that you made. I loved them. I thought they're fantastic. Like they're really, really good. They were kind of, we spoke it, well, we didn't speak about it. We emailed about it. You know, one of the things that struck me about the old K's, Roberto stuff, there's something in the top end of that real kind of, you know, the guys that get it, you know, there's just something in the top end register in their cymbals. And man, your hat's had it. They were beautiful.
Man, I thought, man,
this guy knows, he's got some stuff, man. He knows what's going on. Because, you know, like often I'll play other Smith cymbals and they're great. Like they're all great. I mean, you know, all the guys are doing great stuff. But sometimes I get a bit disappointed in something about the upper register. Not all the time, but again, Roberto had that thing. The old Caves had that thing. You know, some of the great single spits now have that thing. Again, your hats had that thing.
Man,
so
that's high praise. I really appreciate that.
Sibilance,
isn't it? That's the term for it, right? That upper end register, the kind of like, I call it high fidelity nature of a cymbal, and how it's kind of like the difference between like an HD or like a 4K video versus like something that's 360p. You see a lot more detail in that upper register with a cymbal, and that I know what you're talking about that sound.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of like, you know, because obviously, you know, part of what you do when you learn to play a cymbal, you know, like when I was studying at uni and that, I would literally spend half an hour to an hour every day just with a ride cymbal, just a stick and a ride cymbal.
Yeah.
And I would play that constantly to try and extract sounds, you know? So, and after a while you get good at extracting your sound, you know, like you get to find that place in the cymbal and you get to kind of find a way to extract the sound that you like. But with that particular sibilance that we're talking about, if it's not there, you can't kind of extract it, you know. So you can, again, make a cymbal that has that sound different by the way you play it. But if it's not kind of in that cymbal somehow, then you can never really get to it. Sometimes I'll play my spizzichinos and I'll play them so they sound much darker because that's what I'm looking for, but it's nice to know that that kind of upper register sibilance thing is there if I want to go to that as well. Sometimes with some cymbals it's not really there. I'm not going to say brands or anything, but you know, because again, it's not fair on brands and everyone does a whole bunch of different things, but
to me, I like to like what you're saying. To me, it really does mirror the journey of being a musician, because in the beginning, we're just trying to replicate what we love. And then after that, there's a transitional process of only replicating what we love to actually having some sort of identity as an individual.
And yeah, absolutely.
A voice. So I feel like it mirrors that quite significantly. And then, it's also, it mirrors a lot of other pursuits, I would say, like cooking and like photography. If you've ever seen a photo that's way overly edited, like the contrast has been turned way up.
Yeah.
If your eyes aren't attuned to the level of contrast that's needed to make a picture really look beautiful, you end up overdoing it. And I find that like you lose sibilance whenever you overdo. You're kind of pursuing a sound, but you overshoot the mark a little bit.
Yeah.
And then at least where I'm at now, is trying to find that real fine balance so that I'm not overshooting the mark. And it's almost like looking at things through a magnifying glass rather than swinging so wide with my, what's the way to say it? Like just being able to see it on a more detailed level, I guess. We've got the dark, trashy, funky sounds and then the clean sounds, and then there's this entire world between them, and in the beginning you end up just kind of doing one or the other. They're like really, but like finding that middle ground and being able to work in little small increments, I find to be, that's where like mastery is, at least in my mind. That's where I find that the mastery is in those small details.
No, look, absolutely. Yeah, and the analogies you made of, you know, I love red wine as well. Like there's, again, I love coffee. Yeah. Like food, you know, any art, there's so many things where, you know, there's something there, you know, like you can sense it somehow, but how do you get to that thing? Right. Like that the mastery of those guys like Roberto, or again the old K Factory stuff, or you know, where they've sensed that thing and they found a way to pretty consistently, you know, create that, you know, extract that, get that happening in what they were doing. And yeah, that's mastery, right? Like when you get to that level, same with playing, right? Like, it, you know, to me, the players I love, it's almost like there's a consistency in their inconsistency. You know, they're not perfect, but that's the thing I love, right? But there's still like almost a perfection about the imperfectness. You know, it's like they're playing between the cracks and doing all that kind of stuff. You know, it's like it's not perfectly metronomic, but man, there's just something, an essence there, which is really powerful. And yeah, that's what you're going for, isn't it? And like you say, when you start out, it's like riding a bike, you know, like when you're trying to balance, you're always overcorrect, you know, you go too far that way and then you go too far that way.
Yeah.
And eventually you get to that point where, oh, cool. Yeah. I can really stay on that straight. You know, you find that center point.
Right.
And that's what the process is like, right? Like you got that thing, you kind of know it's there somewhere. You're trying to get it and you go too far that way, damn, and you go too far that way. And eventually you go, ah, that's where that thing is. I can kind of get to it kind of consistently now. And that's kind of when the mastery, but you know, that's the 10,000 hours kind of thing, right? It's like, it just takes a lot of time, a lot of experience, but you know, you've also still got to have, you got to have a clarity about what it is you're trying to do as well. You know, like you need to at first kind of at least you have to get in touch with what that thing is that you're trying to create to start with. And I think that's why, you know, for me coming from a musician background, obviously made a lot of sense. I mean, Roberto did too. He was a great player. You know, I'm not saying that you have to be to make beautiful cymbals, but again, you've still got to find that, you know, like I'm not very esoteric, but you know, we're all trying to find that magic element that just makes something work, right?
Yeah.
Like, you know, like I was listening to Sissy Strut the other day, you know, like the Zigaboo thing.
Oh yeah.
Man, I love that groove, right? It's just amazing. And I've been trying to play it for a million years and I can just never do it the way that Zigaboo does it.
Nice.
Again, it's like I know what that thing is. I still haven't found that way to get there, but I'm still gonna try, you know. But and yeah, cymbals are like that too, right? Like you kind of get an essence and you try and find a way to recreate that and hopefully get some consistency with the way you recreate it. But
yeah, that's what you've said really has kind of put this idea in my head, and I don't really know where this thought or question is going, but one thing I've been thinking about in my own making recently is that I feel like I've come to a place of learning how to consistently create a clean sound. And so now since I'm able to do that, I find myself wanting to dial back and allow in more inconsistencies. Like you were saying, like allowing in imperfection, but in a way that has a real grasp of, or has like a mastery element to it, where you're allowing for maybe a tone in one portion of the cymbal, but you're doing it in a way that it's not going to overpower everything, but you're like letting it be there so that it becomes this other color that's a part of the cymbal that, you know, you can go to that place and it can come out. And that's what I find with like Roberto's stuff. Anytime I get the chance to play one, is it seems like he really had a sense of being able to leave in this imperfection, and he called it like ugly sounds. Like he likes ugly sounds. He doesn't you know, anyone can make, everyone's making clean, beautiful sounds.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's something that really fascinates me, and maybe is something that is more like the next frontier for me, is what does it look like to in an intentional way leave in some of that stuff. Because one thing that people will say about my cymbals will say, oh, those cymbals are really, or that cymbal is really clean and consistent. And I take that as a compliment, but I also find myself gravitating towards that. It's the Zigaboo thing. It's like the way he places the notes isn't perfect. It's not a machine, you know,
that's it.
Because of that, it like pulls at you. Like I find that with, listening to Dave King, the drummer, Dave King.
Yeah,
God
beautiful.
Bless. Like when I listen to him play, like obviously he's got the technical prowess that a drummer of his level usually has, but it's like he plays in a way that's almost childlike or playful. He's like,
Absolutely.
Inconsistent in a way that it really draws you into the music and it makes you feel like you can connect with it. I don't find that I can really connect with, I don't really connect so much with chops drumming or gospel drumming, because to me it's so perfect. It's so precise. As much, and to be honest, I might get some hate for this, but as much as I love Vinny Caliuta, I don't connect with Vinny as much as I connect with Brian Blade, because there's such a technical prowess and perfection to his playing, and the execution is so on it. I just find that I connect with something that's a little bit more messy, because it feels like, it almost makes me feel like I could do that. Like, I listen to Dave King and it makes me think I could do that, even though, you know, I'll never play like Dave King, and that's not the point. Maybe the point of saying that is that it just draws you in and it makes you connect with what that artist is saying. So
yeah.
Talk a little bit about what you think, like, how do you think that relates to the cymbal world? Like, how does it relate, and do you think
about
your stuff?
Like, I mean, I think all this stuff relates, you know, like, because the thing you're saying about Dave King, like, he has this way of kind of getting to that inner child thing, right? But there's the beauty about it is that there's, I don't know, it's like a Salvador Dali or something as well, you know, like, his stuff is crazy, but there's real discipline somewhere in the craft as well. So he's got that discipline first, but then he's prepared to kind of, you know, let the perfection go to one side to get more into that kind of childlike spirit of what he's doing, right? And that's so attractive, right? Like, when you listen to anything that has that thing, again, like, for me, the Sissy Strut thing, or, you know, a bunch of other Meters things, or James Brown stuff, or, like you say, Brian Blade. You know, I was playing along to Wayne's thing today, you know, like, what a great groove, right? Like, again, but yeah, these guys, so they really have the technical thing happening, but they're prepared to make that secondary to, like, the exploration and the fun and letting something else happen outside of that. Do you know what I mean? Like, because you can be a totally technical person and make things which are technically amazing and beautiful, and that's great, and that's a skill. But somehow, like you say, for me, you miss the connection with those things. They're almost too perfect. They're like a museum piece, you know, they're amazing to look at for a little while, or amazing to listen to for a little while. But after a while, you just kind of go, you don't feel something emotionally with it, right? And it's the same with the bronze, right? And what you're saying is very much something that happened with me as well. Like, you know, when I first started out, you know, I tried to make perfect cymbals, perfect shape and perfect hammering, and, you know, like, no flat spots anywhere in the cymbal, and just, you know, really beautifully integrated spreads where there's no notes kind of popping out or anything. What I noticed about Roberto's was it was usually the opposite of that, was the things that I loved. You know, it was the funky things and the weird stuff. And, like, you had to form a relationship with that thing because it wasn't perfect. But, you know, once you took that time and you got to know it and you got to know all its kind of idiosyncrasies and nuances, it kind of meant that somehow you could connect with it more when you were playing it. And, you know, after all, like, that's kind of what we do as humans, right? Like, we connect to things, you know, we connect to things in all sorts of different ways, but we want to have some kind of emotional reaction to something. And often, yeah, the perfect things are amazing. And, you know, you have that awe thing where you go, that is amazing. But sometimes you don't keep that emotional connection. That's something which intrigues me and interests me. It's why I love improvised music too, because there's always risk going on. You know, there's got to be an element of risk. And I kind of try and do that when I make cymbals now. I always introduce a little bit of an element of risk when I make it, because somehow going there, exploring, it's like the Dave King thing. It's being a little bit childlike, you know, a little bit naive. But still having obviously enough technique that you're not going to totally ruin something, but yeah, somehow you want to try and get some of that essence into the thing that you're making as well.
Yeah, it's like letting go of control, and trusting that the work you put in, the technical work you put in, is going to cover you, but you're not like trying to manipulate that or really like force an outcome. I definitely noticed that with symbols that I love doing commissions because I find it to be a challenge. And sometimes commissions come along with, you know, I want you to make it like this symbol from this record.
Yeah.
And so in that case, I have to really get my mind into a space of that childlikeness. And I really have to, while also aiming for a sound, let go of the control or like the need to perfectly hit it at the same time. It's like a weird balance doing that. Cause if I am just trying to force the metal into that one place, I just find that it usually falls flat for me and I don't connect with it. Like I would really want to, in order to feel inspired playing it. And then there's all kinds of other stuff that we could talk about, like just perspective and how a symbol sounds behind it, but then how it translates out front. And then also,
important.
It's a whole thing about, a lot of indie makers are making really, really thin, wobbly cymbals. And then, you know, you take that thin cymbal, is that going to be your main ride in a quartet setting and you're playing outdoors and you need that cymbal to cut? Like there's also an element of, for myself, just kind of, I've had to train myself to think beyond what I'm hearing to imagine what it's going to sound like 30 feet out in front, and almost design in those elements into your cymbal so that you know that the cymbal will do the job, but it will also be inspiring in it. And that's kind of where you're falling in that sort of really detailed area where it's not one pole or the other and you're not swinging so wide, but you're really zoning in on something. With like a microscope, it's like you're designing something to be inspiring and to really pull music out of the player, but also translate, and so that quarter note can be heard, you know, 30 feet in front, and you know, even the bass player, he's 5 feet away, he can hear the quarter note and
leave.
It's all of that. How do you think about that in terms of when you're making cymbals, and do you have a lot of people that come to you with really specific requests about like this one record, or how do you sort of balance like what people are hearing given they're listening to that record from 1965 that was recorded with that technology, it's going through their headphones, and it's changing in all these ways, and you're trying to actualize a symbol that's going to capture a similar vibe? Like, do you delve into those waters, or like how do you think in terms of that that stuff?
That's a really good question. I do get a lot of very specific requests. Usually what I do is I say, look, I'll have a couple of goes at it. I guess I'm in the fortunate position where I don't have trouble selling stuff. So I know that, you know, even if I make something that particular client doesn't like, I can still on-sell it. So it's not, you know, I'm not losing anything myself. Often I'll just say, look, I'll have a couple of goes at it. If it doesn't work out, well, it just doesn't work out, you know. So what do I do? Usually, like you say, it's from video or sound files. So immediately everything's colored, right? Like you're dealing with mics and rooms and different sticks and all those kinds of things. So like you, I think I'm trying to, it's more I'm going for a vibe of what I think that thing is. So, you know, I'm not going for an absolute direct copy. I'm going for what are the elements about that sound that are really attractive to me, and trying to put those into another instrument. You know, it's like, I don't know if we're going to cook a pasta sauce, you know, and we're both doing a tomato-based pasta sauce. You're going to bring it's still tomato-based pasta sauce, and it's going to have the same basic, or let's say puttanesca, right? It's going to have the same ingredients, but I guarantee you, if you and I do it, it's going to taste a bit different, right? Like, it's going to have a vibe. We know it's a puttanesca, but it's kind of got a different kind of thing, right? So I guess the hard part with all of those recreations is trying to get enough of that original vibe. So, you know, you're making a puttanesca, you're trying to keep it to the vibe of what you think that puttanesca is, you know, like a real authentic Italian or whatever it is. But you're also just still, you know, I think that I've got to put something of myself into the things that I'm making, or otherwise what's the point of me doing it, right? Exactly. So I don't want to get, you know, I'm not a machine. I don't want to just make things that people want to play that I feel like I had to somehow, you know, reduce my personal input into making that thing. You know, I want my input to, you know, Roberto's input was all over his cymbals, right? Like you just see it and you hear it and you feel it. It's just there. And, you know, the old case from all the years, they had a vibe, right? That there was a thing in those cymbals. Like it was just there. And I think that's the magic. So I don't want to kind of just, again, like do things that I haven't had some kind of real input in a more kind of visceral way with what I'm making, you know, like, yeah. So that's kind of my approach. I don't know if that really explained it, but like, I'm not trying to get, you know, if someone says, can you do a Tony Williams thing? I'm not trying to make that, you know, Tony Williams symbol off of four or more or whatever it is, you know, like I understand what the vibe of that symbol is, and that's what I'm trying to create, you know, like, so what do I think the elements are in that symbol? You know, like what do I think the general spread is, the sibilance, what are the things that stand out to me about that symbol? I want to try and get those basic things in there to some degree, but I still want to also have some kind of, I feel like, you know, I'm selling the craft short if I don't put some of myself in there still as well.
Totally. And yeah, I find you said something to me over email. This was probably like, this might have been a year ago or something, the first time I reached out. But you said something about profile height and how a lot of like where you're finding the sounds that you really like kind of comes in at a lower place. And we talk about old Ks, we talk about these, the cymbals that kind of have a wow factor to them, to like jazz heads, are like the dry complex. It's just got such a different sound than we're used to that our ears kind of perk up instantly. And then the more time we spend with them, we might find, well, maybe that's not actually going to work for me and what I need. Maybe it does, but you know, that was my exact story, was like, I wanted to sound just like Bill Stewart. So I bought a dry complex and I took it to the gig. You know, the day I got it, I had a gig that night. I took it there and like first four measures, the saxophonist turned around and was like, stop playing that cymbal. Like he hated it. And it was like that moment I realized like, oh, this is not for me. And like, I'm not going to be able to be myself on this cymbal. So in that, I've really been thinking a lot about just the shape of our cymbals, you know, what degree does that curvature come in? And, you know, it's very, in the beginning, I made a lot of tall cymbals because I was just wrestling the metal, trying to get it into shape, and it just keeps getting taller and taller.
So
there was all that ka kind of thing was in every cymbal that I made. And I find that that's where you sort of lose that sibilance, is in those really umbrella shaped cymbals. You get that ka sound to come in, but it almost sounds like you're muffling, like the sound of it kind of feels like muffled and rounder, you know. So
Well, you're kind of reducing the spread, right? Like you're getting rid of some of that bottom end, some of that kind of nice undertoney stuff, which to me, I mean I love that when I'm playing. And yeah, you're making it just a bit more mid-rangey, and also some of the real tops kind of tend to go as well when you're doing that. You lose either end of the spread.
It's like it kind of gets squished. It's like it almost
Exactly. And, you know, that can be a vibe and that can be good for certain things. But I kind of feel like, you know, I mean, I do make some one-trick ponies. You know, I do make things which are super trashy or super clean or super whatever. But I prefer to make a symbol that, you know, has the ability to exist in quite a number of different styles and settings, you know. Because to me, it's still up to the player to know how, like, to get a sound, you know, because I'm sure you've had the same thing. I had the experience where, you know, I've been asked to make a Nefertiti symbol, right? Like, that's one of the classic things, right? And so I've made this symbol and I love it. I'm going, man, I got all the vibes I wanted to get in there. I totally dig this. Of course, it doesn't sound exactly like Tony Williams because, again, it's not the 60s, man. And it's, you know, there's different technology and different everything. But I just nailed the vibe. I totally dig it. I love it. And you send it off and the person goes, man, I don't sound like Tony at all. And it's like, well, of course you don't sound like Tony. Like,
yeah.
Why do you think you're going to sound like Tony Williams, man? It's like right. No, it doesn't work like that, you know. Yeah. Like, you're not Tony Williams. Like, you know. You're still yourself. So
right.
You have to kind of find that relationship between you and the symbol, right? And find the way that both of those things work the best for each other, you know? Like, it's always a relationship.
Yes.
You know, one of my favorite Spizzes, took me a long time to love it, you know, because it's such a wild symbol, but I love that it's wild. But it took me a long time to really get to actually really make that symbol feel like, you know, it's a voice that I really relate to, you know.
Yeah.
Because again, it's a crazy symbol and I can go in so many different directions and it's up to me to make that thing work. And once I figured it out, it's like, oh yeah, this is like great. You know, all those things that I may have disliked in the beginning, I'm like, I love this now because I can control it. You know, I've found a way to make that work for me. Like you were saying before, you know, it's like, I think a bit of funk in a symbol is great because it gives it color. It makes it project a bit more. You know, you don't want too much because obviously it's like everything. It should exist within a spectrum. But a bit of kind of funkiness, a bit of stuff that's in there that isn't actually pure and perfect, I think that's good because it makes it interesting. It means that, again, it'll project more. It means that you as a player have got more possibility to investigate different sounds and stuff as well. So, yeah, I don't know. I like that stuff. And you look, yeah, as we know, we cannot perfectly recreate any symbol. It's not that kind of gig, right? Like it doesn't work like that. It doesn't matter whether you're Zildjian or Paiste or Sabian or Meinl or whoever it is. You know, if someone says, I want a symbol that sounds like Tony Williams on Miles Smiles, they're not going to nail it, right? Like it's not actually possible to do that. So you just got to go for the vibe of that thing and try and get that in there. And then hopefully the player can then extract something that works for them within that kind of vibe, within that general tonality of the thing, you know?
That's a really good way of putting it. I also think that, I think that inherently we, maybe as humans, it's easier for us to latch on to something that we love.
Of course.
And kind of force ourselves into that box of like, you know, I did that in my early 20s. It was like, I just wanted to be Bill Stewart.
It's a worthy pursuit.
Yeah, it's definitely a worthy pursuit. And I learned a lot. But then, you know, in a sense, you have to come to that moment. It's not that it was bad that I did that. But I had to come to a moment of realizing, like, I was trying to put myself in the box of being Bill Stewart or being Brian Blade, or, you know, I had a little stint where I wanted to be Mark Juliana, and then it was, you know, Billy and Elvin and Tony, and, you know, you're just constantly struggling with this. Maybe it's a human tendency to just want to be something that you're not. And then there's like a bittersweet moment of realizing I'll never be that. Which is kind of the I would say like the most exciting part of being an artist is the fear that comes up and it's that like, well, what does it mean to be me? What does it mean to have my own voice? And that's just kind of like a dangerous realm that I don't think a lot of people really, maybe it's that people are too scared of that, or maybe they think that they don't have anything in them that's, you know, that could be actualized into something.
Well, I think it's vulnerable, right? I think it's like you make yourself vulnerable when, you know, it's like falling in love, right? Like you kind of, you're putting yourself on the line, and it can kind of hurt, right? Like if it gets rejected, or, you know, because let's say that you decide that a particular sound is your sound forever and everyone else hates it. Like that's soul destroying, right? Like it's vulnerable to be there.
Yeah.
And I think that's tough, right? So, but I also think that, like you say, that's where the magic is. I mean, let's face it, who is always going to be the best Bill Stewart ever in the existence of the planet? It's going to be Bill Stewart, right? So you can only ever be second best to him. So you might as well find another way of being kind of really good at being, you know, Timothy Roberts or like whoever it is. Certainly take from people and take from, you know, get all the inspiration you can from all the things. But at the end of the day, you have to be yourself, right? And you have to be, like you say, vulnerable. You got to be honest and real. And what are my strengths? What, everyone has weaknesses. What are my weaknesses? Be honest about them. You know, fess up, kind of put yourself out there and explore what it is to be you. And again, that is hard and it can be tough. I mean, you know, some artists haven't made their way through that, you know, like seriously, artists have taken their own lives because they put their vulnerabilities out there, and they have been really wounded by doing that. And it can be tough, but at the same time, it's like transcending too. Like, you know, if you kind of feel like you had this clear vision of the essence of the thing you want to create, and somehow you made that happen, that's pretty amazing that you can even do that, you know, like take something that's in our crazy mind and then feel like you've realized that in any art form, or, you know, in any symbol you've made or something. That's amazing that that can even happen, right? So
it's a worthwhile pursuit to try, you know, and even if it happens once every 10 times, it's like, it's that one time is, you can sustain you moving forward, you know?
Well, yeah, absolutely. And I mean, like that's kind of, again, that's what we're here for, right? Like, I mean, I can't remember who said it, but you know, the basic idea is that the whole idea behind art and relationships and all that stuff is to actually make you a better person, to make you a better you. That's actually the whole point of it, right?
Yeah.
So, and that requires, again, like time and energy and dedication and honesty and vulnerability and failure, you know, like we all fail, right? So man, I can't tell you how many times I've failed making symbols, right? Like there's, you know, there's a lot of my symbols that have ended up in recycling bins, right? Because it's like, man, that just totally did not work, and I can't, you know, that's whoops. But that's how you learn too, right? So
do you feel that so I'll ask this question first, and then we can maybe, because I've got a, I guess, kind of an idea of where this thread, but do you feel like Roberto, because one thing that I, you know, I have this like artist side of me, and then the other side of me is like the business minded side of me, where it's I'm trying to make my, you know, plant my flag in this industry and have people know that I do this, you know? So there's like a business side, there's an artist side. So first question is, do you feel like Spizzichino, do you feel like he really just planted his flag into like, this is what I'm doing, and then people kind of just caught on eventually to what he was doing? Or do you feel like there was an element of him, was there a business mind? Do you, I mean, you might not know, but like, do you feel like that there was a business side to Spiz as well as this kind of artist side that just was like, I'm going to make what I make, whether you like, you know, you can connect with it or not. I'm just going to do it in this pursuit of curiosity and what's possible. I don't know if that question even.
I think I know what you're asking. Yeah. I mean, from my experience of Roberto and, you know, his workshop and like obviously talking to him and, he used to have a guy, Luciano, who would take people kind of from the airport to his place and stuff like that. Talking to Luciano, talking to Lee Ruff, who used to bring his cymbals into the States. My understanding of Roberto is that it was really just about the passion of making cymbals. And again, because he was good at it, because he was great at it. Like, people latched on, right? People got it. And so, yeah, I don't think, I mean, that's why he had people like Luciano, because I don't think he really thought about the business much, you know. It was really just about his passion and exploring that. And man, he was really good at it. When I was at his workshop, he had this orchestral, I think it was like an orchestral 18, an old K. I can't remember what series, but like an old K. And one of the orchestras in Europe somewhere had asked him to recreate this cymbal. And he showed me two of his attempts that he'd done recreating this cymbal. Man, they were amazing. That was so close. Like it blew my mind. It blew my mind, you know. It's like, wow, okay, that's next level. Like, he could actually really do that stuff, you know. Like, it was quite amazing to me. You know, the hammering looked the same, the lathing looked the same, the sound was, you know, there were different, obviously, pitches and stuff in there, but like, again, the general vibe and essence of that thing, man, he really got that. I was amazed. So he really knew what he was doing, as well as obviously having that real artistic ethic as well.
So that kind of is what I was anticipating you would say. I mean, kind of the sense I get to from the study that I've done about him, and the people I've talked to that knew him. And I guess my part two to this question is, and maybe this is a consequence of it, him being a part of like a bygone era. No pun intended, because wasn't that his little like symbol line, the bygone? I didn't mean to do that, but that, you know, stupid dad. I'm a dad 6 months ago, so I gotta, you know, try to throw out.
You gotta have dad jokes. It's something you have to develop, man. You gotta try them out.
Very niche dad jokes.
Well, hey, even better, man. Great. Right? The more niche, the better.
Right. Yeah. So maybe he's a consequence of like a time gone by. I find that the world we live in now is so consumerist, it's capitalist. So much about, like, if you can throw the word old K into the mix of your symbol, that, and you market it as like, this is an old K clone, that is like the way to really capture a certain audience that really wants that sound, and it ends up living in a very cookie cutter kind of businessy world. And I find myself really torn, because, like, you know, I obviously need to feed my family.
Of course.
But yeah. I mean, if, you know, if money wasn't an issue, all I would do is just go down there and just take a piece of bronze with no agenda other than the agenda that is inspiring me at the moment. And I would just go to town.
Totally.
And I'm wondering, do you feel like in this world that we live in now, is there a place for people to have like maybe the spiz mentality when you're approaching this, and is that something that can work in the world we live in today? I kind of see that you're doing it, honestly. That, you know, that's my take, at least, that you're
that's really sweet. I thank you, I appreciate it.
But, you know, just talk to me about like your thoughts on that, however you want to take that question, honestly.
Yeah, I mean, it's a pretty noisy world out there, right? Like, the biggest issue is trying to gain traction with all the noise, you know? Like, that's hard for anybody. And as you say, we all have realities. We all have, you know, debts and mortgages and families and things. Like, you've got to do what you need to do. You know, it's like being a musician. You know, if you got to do cover gigs, you got to do cover gigs. You know, I don't bemoan anyone that's a working musician. You got to do that stuff to pay the bills. Like, that's just part of it, right? So, and you know, I don't feel like I have that ultimate freedom either. You know, like there's still a lot of projects that I take on as a favor, or I go, oh, I like that guy, I'll do it for him, or, you know, like,
yeah.
So I still feel like I'm still doing things to pay the bills or for favors or for, you know, where I don't get ultimate artistic kind of freedom, you know. And I don't know how Roberto would have felt about that, whether he thought he had 100% artistic freedom. I know there was a time and you know, it wasn't that long. So like I say, I went and visited him in 2008. And I know there was a time about 10 years before that where, you know, he was struggling. He didn't have a lot of symbols. It kind of, you know, he wasn't making a lot of money out of it. It was hard for him to get blanks from various places. And, you know, things were tough for him too. You know, like, even though, again, he was still making great stuff. So it is a reality. But I also think too, though, that if you're really passionate about what you do and you find a way to do it authentically and well, I think people will kind of find you, you know, enough people to make you at least be able to eat. Yeah. We, you know, when none of us are getting rich doing this, right? We don't do it to be rich. Like, man, if I wanted to get rich, I'd stop making symbols tomorrow and go and do a million other things. Right. But, you know, it's a passion, right? So I guess I feel like it's a pretty rare privilege really in this world to be able to, you know, do something which you're passionate about and you feel like you know, you have a lot of connection with and you get a lot of fulfillment from doing. It's like not many people get to do that, you know. So
yeah.
I don't know, if we can do it and feed ourselves. And like, I think it's just balance. Yeah. So like, if you feel like 10% of what you're doing is total freedom, I think that's pretty good. And maybe you can get it up to 20% and maybe you can get it up to 50%. Will you ever get it to 100%? I don't know. But I guess, you know, at least if you can even do that at all, you're doing pretty well, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, I guess getting back to your original question, I do think though, there's a lot of people that are looking for niche things. There, you know, there are, in terms of the overall market, it's a small percentage, but there's a lot of passionate people out there trying to find other people doing passionate things too. So I think there are people looking for it. It's just not a lot of people. So again, we're never going to be rich, but I think there is still a market for doing that.
Yeah. And it's about, I read a book one time where this guy was talking about, like, when you start a business or you're trying to figure out who your audience is, it's not about finding the largest audience. It's actually about finding the smallest viable audience. Find the smallest amount of people that will support you doing what you love doing so that you can, you know, whatever it is your goal is, if it's just to eat or if you want to have like one vacation a year or whatever it is, you know, you just find that smallest viable audience. And I think in that way, I resonate with what you said about like the percentages of maybe you get 5% of your time to do just what you love and to turn off all of the noise, just do what you love. That might be enough to kind of help push you through those moments where you got to sit there and email for a full day, you know, and
yeah, which we all do, right? Like, yeah, right. We all have those days.
Pay bills or whatever it is.
Yeah. Well, yeah, because nothing is like, I think every job, every career, you know, even if I could play nothing but my original music for, like, you know, do my cymbal smithing for that percentage of time and play my original music for that percentage of time, there's still things that go along with playing original music that I hate.
Yes.
You know, like, even though I love playing original music, but, you know, dealing with venues, dealing with money, dealing with, like, I'm not into those things as much. The promotion, all that kind of stuff. But what I'm saying is there's always a bit of stuff with every job which isn't totally what you want to do.
Yeah.
You know, so like, I think at least if you get to have some time where you're just, you know, pardon the phrase, but a pig in shit, you know, you're just doing exactly what you want to do and loving every minute of it, that's pretty good, you know.
Pretty good, yeah. I With this too, I mean, I don't know that this is really my responsibility at all, but I feel like I don't want to say a calling because that sounds kind of pretentious, but I feel like a pull to try and help the customer understand some of these things that we're talking about, because I find there to be a lot of richness in this stuff, like where we talk about vulnerability, kind of the danger in pursuing an art or pursuing like being an individual or finding your own voice. And I think I feel the pull to do that mainly because when I was early 20s, I had very few people that spoke into my life and said, you know, I see you're going down this path, but let me help you.
And, yeah.
You know, like the people that can help direct you. And it's like, if I can help, especially given that there is such a consumerist mentality and everything is all about like clickbait, even with like making a YouTube video, like it's all about the title you put, and then you got to make it clickbaity enough so that people click on it. I personally like can't stand that stuff, but you have to do some of it. And so even if I have to do a little bit of it, it can be in the service of actually having some kind of message that helps people sort of understand that it's not all about having a symbol that sounds just like Tony Williams or having a symbol that sounds just like Blades Spizzes. Like it's about you as a person, like developing your own voice and feeling confident enough and brave enough to pursue who you are as an artist. If that's like what you feel like you want to do with your life, maybe you're just like a weekend warrior or you play for fun. I would say even in that instance, there's still a lot of joy and beauty to be had in finding your own voice, even if it's just that you play by yourself in your basement, you know?
I find
myself kind of, you know, I think about these things all the time, and I wrestle with these, they feel like competing thoughts, like the artist side, the technician side, you know, the business side, the, you know, what's fun and fulfilling side. And it is like what we're kind of saying is that it's all about some sort of balance.
Yes.
To those things, you know.
It is. Yeah. Balance. I mean, yeah, that's, the older I get, it's like, that's what I realize is the trickiest thing is finding balance in your life generally, right? Like, you know, because we all have competing things for our time, right? Like we have families and you got to put time in there or else you won't have a family. So you got to put time in there. You got to put in time to all sorts of other things that you may not necessarily want to, like they say, paying bills, like shopping, doing all this kind of stuff. But you've got to hopefully, I think, again, it's about being able to balance those things so that not one thing dominates. So, you know, like for me, you're always kind of flowing in and out of all the things. So if you're doing something you don't really enjoy, well, you know, you won't be there for too long because, you know, the balance will bring you back to doing the thing that you really love, but you can't stay there forever because you have other realities and off you go there. But it's about getting the balance right so that you never feel like you're overwhelmed by any one of those things, you know? And that's hard. I don't know if you ever perfectly find balance. But I mean, it's a worthy goal, right? And I think, yeah, it makes you a lot more content and fulfilled if you can, you know, try and find that balance. But what you were saying before as well, you know, to me also, it's like we're social creatures; we exist in communities, you know. And I love your idea. Like, we should be about creating communities, you know. As artists, we should have communities where we help support each other. You know, I'm about supporting each other. I think that cooperation for me is better than competition. You know, like I get the competition. There's always healthy competition and that's great. But, you know, I still think that cooperation is what helps all of us kind of, you know, get to a place where we can be more fulfilled, you know, like in small communities and I think we need those communities as well, which is, again, what you're doing is great because you're helping create that community, you know, by putting that information out there. I, you know, I'm not so great at that. I just do my thing, and yeah, and again, I'm happy. I love talking like this and talking to people generally and stuff like that. But you know, I'm not a social media guy, or I'm not that kind of figurehead person, you know, as much as I totally think it's an amazing thing to do. So man, I think that's great. Like, yeah, if you can create communities, create cooperation, bring people together with, you know, like minds, similar ideas and goals, you know, that help support each other through things, that's great. That's what we should be doing as people, right? As humans.
Definitely. Definitely. And we all have our place in that, and we all have our like role to play, maybe, or whatever it is. And like, I know you probably know Dave Collingwood. Out of the UK. He's been for years now doing this thing, training young Simblesmiths, and he's created like a community there. And you know, I wasn't meaning for this to happen, but it's kind of leading into one question I had, which, because you're part of kind of, maybe call it the old guard, where like when you learned how to make symbols, there wasn't information about how to make symbols. You had to do the work, and you had to go fly to visit Spiz, to visit Steve Hubbick, you know, to visit Pisces. You had to put in a little bit more effort to get there. And now we're in a place where obviously things are all online, and there seems to be kind of this blooming of this industry, even though it is very niche still. There's something like 50 to 100 independent symbolsmiths now, when there was like 10. So what are your thoughts on where this little niche industry is going, and what have you noticed about it, and you know, where do you think it's going, I guess?
That's a good question. Again, for me, having more people do it is great. But I guess there's the caveat again that, like, hopefully as long as we do it in a way where we're trying as much as possible to help each other and cooperate with each other, and not, you know, not kind of cut people down, and not to, you know, it's like, I don't like that side. And I don't see that in our community, which I think is really, really lovely. You know, like I did a symbol with, you know, Nicky Moon mm-hmm. symbols.
Yeah.
So I did a symbol with him and Dave, and like, it was a symbol around the world thing. And I think the money was raised for some music charity. And you know, I communicated a bit with Dave, and he was lovely, and Nick was lovely. And Jesse Simpson, do you know Jesse? Mm-hmm.
I'm going to be talking to him actually next week.
Yeah. He came to my workshop. Lovely dude. And man, we had a great chat and time. And so, and Matt Nolan is a beautiful guy. Again, I met him quite a while back, and we still communicate a little bit as well. So all the guys that I've come into contact with, they seem to have their kind of hearts and minds in a good spot. And so that's great. I, you know, the more people, if we can all eke out a living for ourselves, the more the merrier, you know. If it gets to the point where we can't, well, that'd be sad, and maybe we'd have to rethink how everything works. But I don't think we're in that situation, you know. I think everyone's got their own kind of slight take, slight different variation on things. And again, it's... I like the fact that there's a lot more guys doing it. It's better for drummers. It's again, it's better for our craft. It's like, you know, this is a craft now. It's not just a couple of dudes doing it, like, you know, when I was doing it. So I think that's really good. And my hope is that, it pushes more and more people to do that, and more drummers will support this whole thing. You know, again, any independent, I don't care who they support, but the notion of having independent cymbalsmiths. And again, if more drummers support it, we can have more and more people doing it. And that to me is all great. So,
There's enough of a market share, I think, we could take from the big guys.
Well, I think so. And I think it's growing. Like I said before, you know, I think there are a lot of drummers out there that want to support other artists, other artisans doing something which is unique and you know, something that, you know what it's like. If you buy anything where you know the person that created that thing was really passionate about it, it holds more meaning for you, you know?
Yeah.
So we kind of, I think, you know, people with that artistic mindset, they gravitate towards those things. So I think there will always be a market for it. And as far as I can tell, it's growing. Like, you know, I mean, I still got lots of business, and there's 50 more guys doing it now. It's not like my business has dried up. So I think that's fantastic. So, you know, my hope again is that more and more drummers see the benefit of it as well, and it just gets supported more and more, and, you know.
Yeah. I think too, the type of customer that gravitates towards what we do also is the customer that doesn't tend to get caught by brand loyalty. So I find like my personal take is that, like, I want to get a symbol from you. I want to get a symbol. I have a Collingwood symbol. I want to get a symbol from all of my favorite makers.
Yeah,
I want to
yeah.
create like a color palette that I can pull from for whatever kind of music I'm making. And I think a lot of the guys that want these kinds of symbols are that way. So you can sort of, like, that's where the community thing helps. Cause I mean, if we're connected and if it's a tight knit community, then people know it's not really about competition. It's not, are you team Sabian or team Zildjian? Like, it's not really about that. It's like, I've got a Lordson, I've got a Bettis, I've got a Ray Burn, I've got a, you know, Mongiello, like and I use them for the different things. I mix and match to create the palette that I want to have for certain types of gigs.
Yeah.
That to me is where, like, the whole other side of this symbol smithing thing, it's like we have one part of the relationship with that bronze and making it, but then there's a whole nother relationship that happens once we ship it out. You were talking about with just learning how to play it and that whole relationship with the person who owns that symbol and the music that's going to be made. It's like a whole separate side of things. So yeah, as of now, I've been kind of amazed at how little drama there is in the indie symbol smith world. Cause you think any industry where there's, like, it's niche and there's, like, a small number of people doing it, you'd expect there to be a little bit of, like, you know, button heads, but there really isn't. Even behind the scenes, I can say, like, there really isn't.
Yeah.
Drama, if any drama, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Which is lovely, right? I think that it's, you know, it's about, I guess, people's values too, about what they value and what they want to see happen, you know. And we seem to be lucky that the people have similar values, you know. They're about the craft, they're about the art, they're about the passion, they're about the exploration. You know, every smith like you and all the others that I speak to or communicate with, they're all really grateful that they even get to do this. You know, every single one I've ever communicated with, they're all like, you know, oh man, I'm so happy I can do this and sell some stuff now. And, like, it's, you know, so it seems like the hearts are in the right place, and that's great.
Yeah, it's amazing. I feel the same way. I feel like I totally fell into this, like, just tumbled, you know, head over heels into making symbols when that was not at all the plan. And I can't imagine a better existence getting to, like, I still get to play music, but, like, I was trying to be a professional musician, and I feel like I failed at that, you know?
That's hard. That's a hard gig, man. I know I couldn't do it. I mean, I did a few years, but...
Yeah, I wouldn't have wanted to do it with a family anyway. I wouldn't have wanted to, like, get on the road and do that whole...
But that's it. Exactly. You know? There's a lot of sacrifices in doing that. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, but, you know, I mean... Sorry.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say that, you know, it's like... I think mostly, you know, like, let's say you go to a festival and you see all these great drummers, you know, there's a bit of competition, but I don't know if I haven't had much time in New York. I hear that can be pretty cutthroat. But mostly what I see is people digging the fact that other people are doing stuff and everyone's different and everyone sees the unique value in what other people are doing. And, you know, I think that's what it should be like as an artist, you know, like, and again, life's too short to poison yourself with just bitterness and bad attitude, you know, like it because it hurts you ultimately, right? Like it doesn't help anyone and it hurts you as well. So like, why go there? Like, why be that person? You know, it's not healthy for you. So I want to be inspired by stuff, right? I want to kind of go, oh, that's great. Right. Awesome. You know, like I did when I played.
A lot of that I feel like is in the vulnerability thing we were talking about earlier, and the like letting go of control. Cause a lot of that kind of headbutting stuff and that sort of cutthroat thing, I think is kind of, it's born out of the need to be the best, or the need to control your surroundings or control your environment. And that vulnerability really does like allow for other people to be amazing at something and just to sit in awe of what someone else does and go, wow, you just blew me away. Like you with Spiz, it's like, that blew me away seeing that orchestral symbol that he made. And there's not like, you're not feeling insecure because you're like, oh no, I probably couldn't do that, or oh no, like he's gonna get the business instead of me, or whatever it is.
Yeah,
just can kind of like do away with all that nonsense and just focus on what matters, which is like, it's okay to like let other people be great and to actually allow for room, you know. We kind of all have our own voice. As much as I love your symbols and connect with your symbols, and as much as I've made symbols to try to sound like that one Craig Lauritsen that I heard on the video, like I've done that, as much as that is the case, I still am not you, and I'm not going to make your symbols like we were talking about earlier. Like it ends up becoming like a point of inspiration for me to revel in the fact that I think you make great stuff, or revel in the fact that I think Spiz made great stuff, and then allow that to be something that inspires me to kind of find my own path with it.
And you're using it to elevate yourself, and that's the whole point, right?
Right.
That's what inspiration is, you know. It's like you're using that thing to actually bring you to a higher point, you know, like to be able to explore things more deeply and get different perspectives on things. And, you know, again, every time I play a different symbol, it's you know what it's like. It's like, ah, cool. I like that vibe. You know, that's the vibe that, you know, whether I'm into it or not, it doesn't matter, but it's like, ah, I dig that vibe that they've got going there, you know? Yeah. So again, when I heard your hats, there's a guy in Sydney, James Waples.
Yeah.
This drummer Zeb had some of his stuff. And so I played that, and same thing. It's like, oh man, okay, cool. I like that thing. And he had some funks with him, and it's like, oh, okay, right. I see what the thing is about the funks now, you know. It's like, you know, to me, the aloe is quite interesting in the funks. But anyway, like, you know, it's just great to play these things. They're inspirational. And you know, I have Spizzes. And so when I started out, what I did was I bought cymbals from all of the people that I thought were inspirational. So, you know, I got some Hubbocks, and I bought a cymbal from Michael Paisty, and I bought some Spizzes, and I bought some Skibas and some Johann. Did you ever hear about Johann?
Oh, yeah.
I bought all that stuff because it inspired me, you know, like I wanted to play that stuff. I wanted to kind of see what their vibe was and, you know, just understand more and more. And that's how you do it, right? It's like listening to new music. It's like, oh, hey, that's cool. And it changes something in you. And that's the whole point. So
that's the point. Yeah. Man, that's a great, we should probably wrap up soon. I was going to ask you if you wanted to share any about your, like what you're up to, what you're doing. I know you have like some very interesting like terminology that you use for your symbols that seems to be like what you've created. There's a whole other topic we could keep talking, but I want to just say like that could be a perfect like overarching theme for this whole podcast, is what you just said about like that is I just find I connect with that a lot. That is like the way I find to pursue any art form, really, just to this kind of sense of openness and this sense of community and inviting in everything and not discounting anything. Because you really can learn from anyone, even if
absolutely,
even if I don't prefer a certain cymbal smith's symbols that they make, I can still learn something from it if I just open my mind to it, even if it's not
absolutely
my taste, you know.
So yeah,
I really find absolutely. That to be interesting. Maybe just as like a last little topic. So you have a series you call the Controversial series.
Yeah.
As to what, from what I understand, it's kind of tangentially related to the old K thing. Could you describe how that came about? Because I found that story is very interesting. I wanted to see if you would be willing to talk about that.
Sure. Okay. Well, so that whole series came about a long time ago. So you know about Symbolholic, the website. I think they have an Instagram thing now, something again.
Yeah.
I think I've looked at that a few times. I haven't explored it as in depth, but anyway, back in the day, for, you know, symbol geeks, for people who are really about symbols, there was this place called Symbolholic. And Mike Skiba was there, who was a fantastic American independent smith, really knowledgeable, and, you know, he shared a lot of stuff. Johan van der Sype was on it as well. And Matt Nolan, Matt Bettis, you know, myself, we're all from that similar kind of era and all through Symbolholic. So the Controversial series, there was a guy on Symbolholic who used to say that he could pick an old K from anything, and, you know, any sound file, anything, he knew exactly what all the old Ks were, and he could, you know, absolutely 100% get what an old K was. So I put forward this blindfold test specifically for this person, and I'm not going to mention names. Basically there were no old Ks in that blindfold test. So I got into a bit of trouble, but anyway, blah, blah, blah. So I think it was one of mine and maybe a Spears and maybe a more modern K. I can't remember exactly what was in there. They're all nice symbols and stuff. But anyway, he picked my symbol that was essentially a masterwork symbol that I'd rehammered. It was one of their jazz masters, and I rehammered it in a certain way. Anyway, it just created this big bun fight, and the site melted down, and this guy ended up getting kicked out, and, you know, it was a bit of a kind of a storm for a while.
Yeah.
And so I decided to make a series out of the symbol to call them Controversials. So that's how that whole thing came about, was because of all the controversy about the beginning of it. So in the early days, so this is like, what are we talking? What year are we in? 2023. Let's say 15 plus years ago, probably 20 years ago, really. Anyway, I had this series. And so essentially I was getting pre-made masterwork symbols, whether they were like what they called naturals or sometimes the jazz masters, it didn't really matter. And I was rehammering them, and I was calling them this Controversial series. So these days I can still make those Controversials, but most of them are made from blanks now. I can still make them from, you know, I call them partials because obviously I change the shape a lot. Like I'm basically treating their basic blank and rehammering it.
Yeah.
But most of them these days are coming from blanks, unless there's a request to get a specific sound, which I think is going to work better with that original design goal in mind. So that's how all that came about.
That's interesting. Yeah. There's a podcast, and I need to look this up really quick, but there's a podcast actually Collingwood did with 1 second. Yeah. So he did the podcast with Chad, the guy, Chad Anderson, the guy.
Yeah. He was Symbolholic. Yeah.
And he kind of briefly touched on that Controversial thing when they were talking about just the vitriol that was going on in that group for various reasons, but he kind of touched on that one thing. And I always, whenever I see one of your symbols come up that says controversial series, I always like gravitate towards those sounds. I really like what you've done with that series. And yes, so Chad has, he has redone, he's launched a little Instagram thing for Symbolholic, and that there seems to be a little bit of a resurgence there. But I'm wondering, do you know if that the forum is archived anywhere, or is it gone?
Yeah, I don't know. There are bits and pieces around the place. Like obviously, Chad would be the person to speak to. Some of the moderators back in that day, there was a guy called Steve Black from New Zealand who did a lot of stuff. I think he's got some of the stuff, but there's some great Skiba info floating around that is gold. That would be a real shame if that, you know, got lost in the ether somehow. I imagine Chad would have it somewhere, whether he wants to release it or not, I don't know. But yeah, there, you know, Skiba, you know, he put a lot of really good thoughts and a lot of knowledge, you know, a lot of his knowledge into that site at various points in time. And that was gold for me, because that was pretty much the only info I was getting about symbols. So yeah, that was really important, that whole phase for me. In fact, you know, there's a strong possibility I wouldn't have done what I ended up doing if it wasn't for that Symbolholic site. So,
wow.
You know, I know for me.
Shout out to Chad for that.
Absolutely, man. Totally. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. No, and that was, yeah, as he said, there were often conflicts on that site. So, you know, it was a bit of a heroic effort in some ways from Chad to keep that going. And his wife put a lot of time into that as well. Yeah. But that was kind of the big site for me for information back in the day.
Yeah, that's I started after the Symbolholic days, so I never was able to see the full thing. And I've just, you know, when I was doing my research, I feel like I kind of came in when there started to be a little bits and pieces of information. Like I looked at your site quite a bit and read through all the, you've got tons of information on your site, which remind me of the URL again. It's
symbolutopia.com.
Yeah. So if for anyone, like if you want to learn more about really all things symbols, but crafting symbols, hammering symbols, symbolutopia.com is a really great resource. I remember scouring that website. I looked through that website a bunch, and then I would find kind of the bits and pieces of the forum, kind of the parts that were posted elsewhere, you know, little articles that Hubick would write or whatever. And just kind of end up piecing things together. And then, you know, now there's a lot more information, but it seems like a lot of the really golden information that was a part of that forum is maybe lost to the wind. But
yeah, it's a shame, because, you know, there are a bunch of theories that I still kind of hold to from Mike Skiba predominantly, you know, things like strata layers and all that kind of stuff. You know, that was all Mike Skiba stuff. So I have to completely give all the credit to him for that kind of stuff, you know, like the case and crust and core layers and all that kind of stuff, and how they interact. That was all Mike Skiba, and that was great information for me. You know, really got my brain thinking in a particular way about how I could approach things, and, you know, made me think about hammering, lathing, all those things in different ways as well. Some of his theories. So yeah, they were really good.
Yeah, so we'll have to get. I've actually been wanting to talk to Chad, because I feel like that'd be a really good episode, just talking to him about his experience in it.
Oh, absolutely, man. Yeah, that was a time, the old Symbolholic. I'm sure he's got so many stories.
Yeah, so many. So
yeah,
man. Well, Craig, I am so grateful that you took the time to talk with me. This has been absolutely awesome. One of my favorite episodes for sure. And so tell people where they can find you, what you're up to, anything you want to share about, what you got going on these days.
The symbolutopia.com is the website. I have a YouTube channel as well. You just look for Craig Lauritsen, I think, for that one. But either Craig Lauritsen or Symbol Utopia, you'll find it. And in terms of what I'm doing, still making symbols. And bit of playing, but yeah, if anything interesting I'm doing, I'll try and get it onto the website at some stage if I'm doing CDs or doing something. I haven't done anything for a long time actually, so.
Your YouTube is great too. So you'll post little clips of your cymbals. You posted a bunch this morning, I think. Well, what would be morning to me?
Yeah. I try and keep that going as much as possible. I don't always post stuff. Like often that stuff is for clients to see, so they can, you know, see and hear the cymbal. But you know, sometimes if it's different orders or local people or stuff, it doesn't get onto the YouTube thing, but I try and keep that going as much as possible. But yeah, there's a lot of files on there now. I don't even know how many, but thousands, I'd imagine.
Yeah. Wow.
So, lots. Yeah. And, you know, pardon?
Well, there's a lot to look through.
Yeah. And occasionally I'll post some interesting little cryptic comments in there as well. So
I've noticed.
Click, you know, switched on people will probably see some of the things in there from time to time. So,
right.
Yeah.
Love it. Awesome. Well, Craig, thank you so much. Guys, thank you guys for watching. This has been the Reverie Podcast. We'll catch you guys next time.
Thanks, Tim.